Last November, I got together with my friends Todd and Carrie Alexander, and they put on an incredible event. The first annual Grenache Fest was held in Walla Walla, Washington on November 3rd, 2023. It featured 12 Grenache wines from Washington State producers. After the seminar, which was moderated by yours truly, there was a concert featuring Stephen Malkmus from the 90s underground grunge band Pavement, M. Ward, and Mark Pickerel, who is returning this year as our musical director. It was hands down one of the best wine events I've ever attended. And it was such a success that we're doing it again this year. Save the date, November 8th, 2024. If you're a producer wanting to pour your wines, if you want to volunteer, or if you simply want to attend this year's event, go to GrenacheFest.com and sign up on our email list to be the first to know regarding all things about this year's event.
Hey, I'm MJ Taylor, also known as a black wine guy. I went from being a totally obsessed wine newbie to becoming the world's first ever African-American fine and rare wine auctioneer in less than 3 years. In this show, I'll be talking to the mavericks, the philosophers, the players, and the deep thinkers who inhabit the world of wine. They'll share their experiences on how they made it, but more importantly, how they failed and got back up again. So grab a glass and let's get to it. This is the Black Wine Guy Experience.
Hey everybody, what's up? It's your boy MJ. Welcome to the Black Wine Guy Experience. My guest today is the winemaker at McPrice Myers Wines, Mac Myers. Mac has been crafting high expression wines of balance, value, and place since 2002. A lifelong self-proclaimed food and wine geek, Mac was a quick study and almost immediately he had the press lauding his wines. His passion for unique sites in Paso Robles and California Central Coast, combined with his meticulous attention to detail in the cellar, result in stunning wines that more than live up to the hype. And wine critic Robert Parker Jr. noted, California needs more of these wines in the marketplace. Welcome, Mac.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Man, so glad we got to do this. Thanks for being here. What's the first wine you brought for us to try today, man?
A little rosé. All right. Fresh in your palate.
All right, cool.
And can I make one correction?
Yeah.
It's not really a correction, but an addition.
Yeah.
So my first name is actually McPrice.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to get into that.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah. Well, sometimes it doesn't get talked
yeah,
about.
Yeah, so. No, that's really cool.
But
yeah.
I go by Mac, so it's about half and half the people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, MJ is my first and middle initial, right?
Okay, perfect.
So yeah. Depending on how people know me, like where you met me in life, it's Marvin. My family was Marvin John. My mother was MJ, and when my mom had passed away, so that's why I use MJ. My wife calls me Marv. She ain't calling me MJ. But yeah, and so that's so great. Yeah, so yes, McPrice. So when you guys, you see, I mean, we do this. I do this thing called the 20 Question MJ, and it's for shits and giggles. The whole podcast is for shits and giggles. But I was here with Mac, and I was like, I want to question your favorite athlete, and he said Bo Jackson. He's a Raiders fan. I mean, look at this dude. He doesn't look like a McPrice. Like McPrice, yeah. McPrice is like, he has some golf pants on and a Argyle.
Go to boarding school.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like the third behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it.
You look like a Mac.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's so cool. But I shouldn't.
Big Mac, you know, it works.
Like life and wines, they should be surprising, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, man, I like to start at the beginning. So, where are you from?
I grew up on the east side of LA, the San Gabriel Valley.
Yeah.
Do you know that area?
Yeah.
So, Whittier, La Mirada, Pete Rivera.
Shit.
Yeah.
What was that
That's where the Raider love started.
I know. What was it like growing up there, man?
It's good, man. It was wild. We ran the streets like crazy. Not a lot of supervision, a lot of fun, a lot of trouble. Life went pretty quick though, growing up, you know, you experienced things, at a younger age but that taught me a lot of lessons and it was great. Good Mexican food, good friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you ever see a movie? I don't know if you've seen it. You should check it out. It's called The 90s. And it's about...
I've seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you said, like, no supervision, run the streets. Like,
just run
that,
the streets.
That's what I always get reminded of. Like, that reminds me, I'm like, yeah. You know, just... For lack of it, just being punks. Just being
a punk. Exactly. Whether you're skating or you're on your BMX or you're just, you know, running the streets. I mean, no supervision, you know. There'd be like hours every day. You're just, you know, running the streets and getting in trouble. Find out ways to get in trouble. You know, find your way.
Yeah.
You know, hanging out with your boys. But it was good. I had a good time. Yeah, I really enjoyed my childhood. Playing sports.
Did you play sports in school?
I did, yeah.
What sports did you play?
Football, baseball.
Okay.
Yeah. I was an athlete from, you know, young. I grew up playing sports and it just translated to naturally to high school.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and I started playing baseball in college. And okay. This is kind of how I got into the wine world was I got hurt. Had another elbow surgery and the doctor just said, look, I don't know how to tell you this, but it's not for you. You know, my cartilage was gone in my elbow. So I and a lot of those, my buddies that I was running the streets with, they were working at Trader Joe's. And that's where I started getting in the wine bug.
Okay, wow. We're gonna unpack that because I don't know if you've ever heard any lives I've done, but that's how, like, Jeremy, who were at Jeremy Lefford's house.
Correct.
Got into wine, too, was working at... Mm-hmm.
There's.
And I actually met him when he was working in the wine aisle at Trader Joe's down in Santa Barbara when I lived out here.
Oh,
like,
really?
Back in 04. And, like, you know, it was one of those things we never hung out. But then, like, once we reconnected through, like, pandemic, I was shipping wine. And he was like, I know this guy. And he's like, did you still live in Santa? I was like, yeah. He's like, dude, I used to hang out with you all the time. I goof off. So I think that's great that was a starting point for you. But with the sports. Yeah, so this is great. So... You, what position do you play in football, first of all?
I played middle linebacker and fullback, but then my senior year, I actually played quarterback because growing up, I played quarterback.
Okay.
It was fun. I could throw the ball pretty good.
Right. So, yeah.
Wasn't built like a quarterback, but I could throw the ball really well. I had some wheels, so I can run,
yeah. And
scramble, but yeah.
That's fun, man.
I mean, in high school, I mean, you could play all kinds of different positions. It's not as fixed as it is now back then, but, you know, you could, you know, have a good arm.
Back then was more, for me, I feel sad on one level for how specialized kids become in sports. Like you said, we talked about Bo Jackson, you know, before we started the podcast. So Bo Jackson played football and baseball, but he also ran track.
Yep.
He could dunk a basketball. he was just an insane athlete. And yeah. During that same time period, we had Deion Sanders. You had guys who were just great athletes. It wasn't like, well, I'm going to jump up on this box and do this with these ropes. It was just like your strength and cross training came from doing different sports. That's how you stayed.
Exactly.
You know,
Bo Jackson said he was natural. And when he got to Auburn, they made him go in the gym and said, you know, you got to lift weights. And he goes, no, I don't, that's not my thing. And he did a little bit, but they said, that's not my thing. You know, and so they made him get on the bench. And remember, he did like 32, yeah. 225 yeah, or just, something. Probably, just probably, natural. Yeah. Just natural. And they go, I guess you don't. Yeah. I guess you got it.
Yeah. Or let you keep doing what you do.
Yeah, here, Bo. Exactly. He had an arm. He had a hose out of the outfield.
Oh, remember
those throws he would make?
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he was great.
Insane. And so you play baseball and you mentioned shoulder. So what did you pitch?
Elbow.
Were you a pitcher? Or?
I was when I was growing up. Okay. I had a couple elbow surgeries growing up. I had one when I was really young.
Damn.
Because I played a lot and I probably pitched too much and throw too many breaking balls too early.
Mm.
And then I had a surgery when I was playing college.
Okay.
In Whittier, Rio Hondo College. Mm-hmm. And then once I was done with baseball, I did not like school. I was not a good student. And all my boys were working at Trader Joe's. So
you went to the community college, right? Okay. So yeah, I mean,
Community college.
Community college. Yeah.
I was good, but I wasn't, I was good enough to play third base for community college and maybe something later on.
But. Nice. And so where was this Trader Joe's located?
Whittier.
So right in Whittier.
Yeah. Kalima and Whittier Boulevard.
And so were you still living at home back then? Or are you living in
a place? Okay. Yeah. I was living at home. I moved out shortly thereafter I got that job.
So you got that job.
Yeah, I got that job, and then but that's how I got introduced to wine. Yeah, introduced to wine, and we're really, it's hard to explain, but when you taste something and you find something fascinating,
yep,
I just did. It was totally out of what I was into at that point, you know, drinking beers and hanging out with my friends, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, but I felt something, and you know, you keep feeding that a little bit, but still, like everything else, my parents didn't drink wine.
Okay.
None of my friends drank wine. None of my friends' parents drank wine. It wasn't really something, but I did think it was cool. It was a cool thing. I liked it. There was the history on, and I really was fascinated. And the fact that I started looking into it and reading books told me that, because I hated school. Yeah. I hated all that stuff. That I was interested. And then once I got that bug, and then I turned 21 years old, I went up and visited the wine country, which was for us was like Santa Barbara and Paso.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's so cool. So Whittier, how would you describe the neighborhood you grew up in? Because no one drank wine, really. It's like working class.
Working class, for sure. Working class, you know, everything from, you know, I would say, you know, on the high end side, we're like firefighters and law enforcement.
Yep.
And then on the other side was a lot of teachers. My dad was a teacher.
Okay.
He also worked for the youth authority, so he was in law enforcement for a little bit. And then it was, you know, like manufacturing jobs, truck drivers, you know, very, I would say, you know, middle class ish, mm-hmm. you know. But very working class, a lot of, you know, I would say beer drinking, hamburgers and hot dogs, and you know, and then on the grill, and I would say it was pretty, as food, you know, as back then it wasn't like it was just about what you can get that was affordable and it could feed your whole family.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was doing that,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Fast food was, you know, was a thing, and but then, you know, that was another thing. I started getting into food and realizing food doesn't need to just taste like Taco Bell and McDonald's and, you know, frozen hamburger patties on the grill, right?
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It was like, whoa, you could have this and that. And I remember, like, when I was 21, 22 years old, I didn't really have anybody I would share wine with. And so I would, like, make myself a meal and open a bottle of wine, which I know that you're not supposed to do that. It's not, you know, wine's meant to be shared, but I needed to learn about wine.
Yeah.
I needed to, I had to do it. So I would, you know, and, I just, you know, for a kid that young to do that by himself, I knew that I loved it. I knew there was something there. Then I just got into it, got into that whole thing, food and wine and reading up on stuff and going to all the local wine shops and getting to know everybody there. And I really just kind of just immersed myself in it fully, coming up to the wine country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just retasted this wine. I want to talk about the coming wine country, but it's the Beautiful Earth Rosé.
The 2023 we just bought.
You just bought. Okay. Yeah. So what grapes are in this?
Grenache and Mourvèdre.
Okay. So
it's a tad bit of claret.
Okay.
We threw some of the juice on top of some claret lees.
Okay.
Which is a pretty common thing.
Yeah.
Give little aromatics. But yep. Yeah. So, and half of it was picked to squeeze.
Okay.
So we picked our front block at the winery there at our property, and then we squeezed that, and then the rest of it is some Sangiovese from some really nice lots. Yeah. They have a lot of acid.
Yeah, no, it's really vibrant, minerally. Such,
yeah, look at the color on it.
Yeah,
yeah,
and that's, you know, rosé can run the gamut, but that's a beautiful. You talk about a pale salmon color. Yeah. That's in the pocket right there.
Yeah, that's what we're going for.
Yeah,
yeah, I like, that's my style. Yeah, fresh, vibrant, mineral. You know, aperitif style.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it'd be good to start with.
Yeah, no, it's probably, it's totally like that's when you've said about wine, learning about it, but like, you know, a good bottle of rosé, even like, okay, so this, to have this, I'll take, if I had this in New Jersey, I'm like, oh man, I can feel the breeze coming off civet. Like, it should transport you to the place for where the wine's
sure. Are. Yeah.
And no, I think that nails it. And then on the label, that's, what's, describe that?
That's the Clotta.
That's Clotta, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a, yeah.
Like loyalty and friendship. Yeah, that's our logo.
Nice. So I love what you said. You're like you're like 22 years old, and you're like, you say you made yourself a meal. So were you watching Food Network or like?
No, this was before Food Network. This was just stuff I learned from people, you know, or ask people what they like to make. And,
okay.
You know, people like my bosses and stuff. They're like, oh yeah, I like to do this and that, you know. And
well, Trader Joe's always had the Fierce Flyer. It would have recipes.
Oh yeah, yeah, exactly. So I would take that, right. You know, or just look, you know. But this is before Food Network. This was, right. You know, this was in the late 90s when I was doing that.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I'd take a bottle of Rioja and make some, you know, braised dish or some stew or something and sit there and kind of try to dissect it, you know. But I didn't know why I was doing that.
Yeah.
I just liked it. I thought it was cool. I was like, yeah. This is cool. Yeah. This producer, you know, Marquis de Riscal or, you know, something like that. I would take that and you know, it was cool.
That's so cool. Yeah. It is cool.
And I didn't know why.
Yeah.
You know, but then once I started going up to the wine country and meeting winemakers and seeing the process, then I knew.
Yeah.
I was like, holy shit, this is what I want to do. This is what I need to do. Go into a barrel room and smell barrel room, taste something out of barrel. I didn't know how I was going to get there, but that's something I knew that I wanted to do this in some fashion. I didn't know when either, I knew that I could, if I educated myself and had an opportunity, I was going to take that opportunity.
So when you said you came to, so Wine Country was Santa Barbara, obviously, which...
Yeah. Santa Barbara and Paso.
And Paso.
Yeah.
What were some of the first places you visited?
Oh, back then it was, up here it was like Arciero, it was Mashantuan, it was Norman, it was Tablas Creek was just getting started, it was Adelaida.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? It was Pazenti was before, yeah, Turley bought them.
Yeah, yep.
Who else? It was Dover Canyon. That was in you know, around that time, late 90s and the early 2000s. That was that was when Lene Coloto, Matt Trevison was starting his brand, and mm-hmm. that was the first time I got to taste some Rhone stuff. I remember tasting James Berry Vineyard Designate wines from Wild Horse,
mm-hmm.
back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Those were like the late 90s. Mm-hmm. I remember tasting those. Yeah, so Wild Horse was another one.
That's insane, because I interviewed Justin yesterday and he was telling stories like, yeah, so Ken Volkes, he's like, you know, you should maybe plant some Syrah over there. So they were planting Syrah for a while. Mm-hmm. And Wild Horse is a freaking, it's funny how brands evolve, right? Like, mm-hmm. that, like, you know, you could, and at least when I was California, I was in supermarkets everywhere. But back in the day, they were making some good, not, and even that stuff not with bad, but like when you look back now, like one of the American Grand Cru Vineyard is just mm-hmm. going into a $15 Syrah.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know?
No, I mean, but that was prior to knowing, I think.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, I think if you, I mean, he probably told you yesterday, but I mean, they had, remember they had a lot of Chardonnay.
Yeah, that's what
they had. Chardonnay. They had Chenin Blanc,
yeah,
I think.
Yep.
They had,
yeah, because they still have some Chenin Blanc because we had the 2018 white, so there's a little bit of Chenin Blanc left there.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was primarily, and he said, like, it should have worked. It was Chardonnay and Pinot Blanc because Champagne Dutz was rooming and wanted to, they were going to sell the fruit to Champagne Dutz to make an American
Spot. Oh yeah, Maison Dutz, which is the T-shirt. Yeah, 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 of course. I didn't know that part.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's what's so fun about interviewing all you guys, because you guys call in and like the stories become, the connections become pieced together.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, and so you did that, and then what about down in Santa Barbara? Because that's where I lived when I lived out here. Like, any vendors down? I mean, any producers down there? When you
it was started? It wasn't a lot down there. It was like Gainey,
yeah,
Beckman, and then you had Los Olivos was remember, it was a lot of tasting rooms that
yes.
didn't that weren't winery based.
Right.
There were guys that just poured a bunch of different small producers.
Right, right.
So the one of the ones that you know, when you have a wine, you go, oh shit, that one's really unique and good.
Right.
Was Remember that barn at the end of, in the south end of Los Olivos?
Mm-hmm.
And that guy used to pour wines out. There was like a little market in there. And he poured Alban wines before Alban had a tasting room.
Mm-hmm.
And this would have been probably like 98, 99. And I remember I went in there and he was pouring those wines. And I did. I was like, I recognize those wines are special.
I moved out in 99. Alban wines were fucking like, you know, 25, 30 bucks.
They were.
Yeah. And then, you know, I learned, oh, fuck. Come on. It's on the tip of my tongue. I liked his wines too. Craig. What was Craig's name? Oh, he made Rhone stuff. Oh, it's on the.
Well, the Foxen guys.
Foxen was
they had the little shed.
Yeah.
They had the Foxen guys. They were doing a little bit of Rhone.
You had Cupé back then. You had of course, Cupé, but Zacamesa
for sure. Foxen on that road. I'm trying to think who else on that road. Rancho Sisquoc. Yeah.
You had Brander. He wasn't making Rhone stuff, but Fred with the Sauvignon Blanc and the Bordeaux stuff.
Yeah, you had that. You had, there was nothing in Santa Rita Hills at that point. Melville came
I mean, Melville, it wasn't Santa Rita Hills.
Yeah, no.
Brian Babcock was there making wine. What became Santa Rita Hills.
And then Melville opened soon after, and that was, which became Santa, exactly. Brian Babcock was the only one.
Yeah, it was just Lompoc. Yeah. Back then, you know, and I've said this before, one of the greatest wines I've ever had was a 1996 Babcock Black Label Cuvée Syrah. It was a banger. I remember I moved out in 1999 and we would have that wine. We'd blind it against Ojai and Sean Thackeray shit. And like, And every tasting, it would be in the top three. Like it would come ahead of like bangers, right? Like it was
that wine has been talked about by other people as well.
Yeah,
it was
an epic wine.
Yeah, was that grown on his property?
Yeah, I believe so.
See that property? That's legit for Syrah.
Yeah,
legit for
Syrah. I believe it was like because it was a black label thing. So I think that was the estate bottling. Now there's a guy. There's a guy who I think is so unheralded. Like, so under the radar, believe it or not. Like, outside of... if you know, you know. But, like, people don't know about Babcock wines on the East Coast, really.
No. and a crucial part of Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
You know, he's definitely a big puzzle piece, right? Yeah, that fits into that whole picture, for sure.
Yeah.
And I just had his wines recently from a Nolan Vineyard, which is in Aliso, Katie, a new vineyard coming online. They were great. They were awesome.
Yeah.
He's doing a good job. I love that. I love, you know, Hitching Post.
Yeah.
Those guys were making wine. They were just selling it
out of the restaurant.
Yep.
Yeah.
But when I first started making wine, I was in the facility with them.
Okay.
Which is Central Coast Wine Services.
Central Coast Wine. I haven't heard that.
That was the spot.
Man.
That was the
incubator. Oh, yeah. When I was down there, Seth Coonan.
Oh, yeah. Seth. Of course. Yeah. Seth. And he got his start at Gainey.
Yep.
You had, a lot of guys came through the whole Cupé, ABC.
Parker. People came through Fess Parker.
Yes, which was Joey Tensley.
Yep.
Was a Fess Parker alum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I met him back then. And I think I tasted his first wine. It was like, I think the 98 was his first wine.
Yeah.
I remember having that, and I was like, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty insane. It's and I love how, like, the industry's young, right? Compared to Europe, right?
Our country's young, of course, yeah.
You know, but like, it's pretty insane. Oh man, you know, you got like Eberle out here in Paso Robles.
Of course, Eberle, yeah. On that side of the road, you had it was basically You got Tobin James,
yep,
and then you had Arciero, which then became Eos. You had which was a big one, and then you had Eberle. That was kind of and Meridian.
Yep.
Meridian was there. The Meridian was another one that did some cool wines. I remember they used to do some, like, you know, Benito Ducey single vineyard, Zinfandels, or no, maybe it was Dante Ducey. I don't remember but it was Ducey Vineyard, one of them. They were doing some good stuff. Like, when you go to the taste room, you get all like the really small lot stuff.
Right.
But, you know, their main production was Chardonnay, and back then, even then, yeah.
I love it. So, how long did you work at Trader Joe's?
I worked there for almost 11 years.
Okay, so wow. Trader Joe's, I used to love going in there. Like, everybody seemed to have fun. Great place. They were called crews. People seemed to work together. 11 years, that's a long time. So, were you thinking about, I'm going to make a career here, I'm going to move through the levels, or?
Yeah, I think originally that was the idea. Get promoted to a manager, full-timer. And worked my way up through the ranks, and yeah, for sure, absolutely, that was the goal. And then the wine thing got me, and then there was a certain point where I knew deep down that I was not going to move forward with Trader Joe's. I just didn't know when I could actually leave to make a living at making wine, which is, as we know, is super difficult. You know, just being in business is difficult nowadays. You know, just surviving, but back then it was just, can I make a living doing this? And so that I was able to leave in 2005.
And did you go work somewhere, or you went right into?
I just did it.
You just did it.
I just did it. I found out about this place from Windward Winery here locally.
Good Pinots, man.
Yeah, I was there, and this is like, you know, I was Pinot Noir, and you know, we're, because you're so used to doing it down in Santa Barbara.
But yeah,
was there, and Mark was like, let me hold on 1 second. I got an email from some place down in Santa Maria. They have a custom crush. You can do some things down there. And he gave me the flyer. He was like, here, check this out. And so I contacted them, and you know, it was like I was waiting for them to go like, where did you go to school, who'd you work for, like vet me in some way. But they're like, yeah, come on in for you know, a meeting, still we'll sign, we'll get the contract signed, no problem. And I'm like, really? So I went in there and signed the contract, and then at that point I had a place to make wine, and that's when I met Russell Frum. We struck up a friendship, and we're both the same age, and he was working there. So, you know, brought up barrels. I bought some barrels from, you know, just some neutral barrels from a winery, and brought them up there and bought some fruit, and yeah, just did it. I don't know. It was like, I took my life savings too.
I was going to say, yeah.
Every dollar I had.
So, were you just going to Windward to taste, and you, or you had been?
I was there tasting.
Okay,
and then the guy doing the tasting,
yeah,
whatever, yeah. And I asked him. I basically said, hey, you know, I'm looking for potentially a place to make some wine. You know, a couple barrels of wine. Do you guys do that here? And he said, no, we don't do that here.
Okay,
here's a place that you could probably go to. Mm-hmm. That's their thing. They do it for small wineries,
yeah.
And. Yeah, so it was just luck. I mean, I would have probably found out about it eventually, but it was one of those moments where I was like, all right, cool. I think I can do this. I can find a place. And literally I was like, if I make one vintage and it doesn't work out, at least I could say I made a vintage.
Right.
I made a wine.
Yep.
You know, it was like bucket list thing. I made a wine.
Yeah, I mean, you
and if I'm pouring it 2 years down the road and pouring for some friends, I could say, yeah, I made that.
Right, or and like, yeah, had it gone south, even like you keep a case, and yeah. I made this 20 years ago when I wanted to be a winemaker, right? Like you,
exactly.
I get it. That's so cool.
It was just like, it was one of those things, and I was willing to take every dollar I had, but I was hoping it was going to work out, and and luckily there were so many great people there, as I mentioned, Russell and. You know, but there was like 40 wineries. It was the Hitching Post guys. It was Lane Tanner.
Oh, I remember Lane Tanner.
It was Seth Koonin. Yep. It was Tim Spear, who was a Clomy Mead. Do you remember that guy?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen him in a while, but he was there. And Dave Corey from Core Wines. And Paul Otto was just starting.
Paul Otto.
Yeah, I mean, it was like an incredible... Gary Gibson from Shadow Canyon, which is owned, is a new owner now. And there was just this whole, like, different age groups and... But everybody was really kind of going in the same direction. Everybody just wanted to start a brand and be successful and do this for a living. I mean, so and a tremendous amount of passion. People were just so excited, but it was like an incubator too. You could feed off each other. You could talk to each other. Everybody was really open about things. And, you know, if a winery needed me to do some work, I would do it. Punch downs, clean their equipment. So, because I was only making a small amount of wine, so I would do that. And then, in turn, I would get, you know, I'd be like, hey, can I ask you a few questions? Or, you know, so once you start getting in the community and people, as I always tell people, you sense passion right away.
Yeah.
You feel it.
Yep.
You know it.
Yeah.
And even today when I meet people, you know, you feel it right away or not. Or this person, I don't think they, you know, they don't have the same feeling about wine as I do.
Right.
Let's just say that.
Yep.
But if when I think people recognize that in me and I recognize it in other people, and I think that there's something there. You feed off of it and everybody's kind of, you know, and there's other wineries that have had that, you know, where the small wineries, they have, you know, few producers in there and everybody feeds off each other and let's try this and do this. And it was great, man. It was a really good time. And I look back and that was really, friendships I have today mm-hmm. were built back then.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm really, that was a big part of my life,
yeah.
You know, especially my wine career.
So you're this kid from Whittier and had you moved up here or you just come up and check on your wines? How are you making your wines?
Yeah. So the first few years it was just come up on my weekends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, during the off season, come up every couple of weeks to top barrels, or every, you know, sometimes I would have to come up, you know, and check vineyards, and then I would use my vacation time for harvest. But I was only making a small amount of wine, so
yeah.
I could take off 3 weeks
mm-hmm.
and get the wine, the grapes picked and fermented in barrel, and I would have, you know, five or ten barrels or something like that.
What was that first wine you made?
Larner Vineyard.
And so it is the Larner. I was going to ask you, like, so
that's another thing. Yeah.
So you, in addition to, like, there's this custom crush, like you saw, I was like, someone like, Larner Vineyard grapes for sale, right? Is there some weird, or was that?
Oh, yeah, no. It was on the board at Central Coast Wine Services. And I always tell people, it's like, you know when you went into, like, Guitar Center and it says, hey, man, we need a drummer.
Right.
And they had those little, the numbers of the little tags.
You
pull off the tag. That's exactly what it was like. And it was like, grapes for sale. We went and looked at it, and Russell went and looked at it as well, and it was like instantly you felt it. I mean, the soil, it's like this bitchin' sandy soils, and it's in Ballard Canyon, and it's, you know, before Ballard Canyon was known as Ballard Canyon,
yeah.
But it was a sweet spot. You felt it. You know, there's a lot of, for me, I don't know how to explain it, but there's a lot of, it's a lot of feel for me,
mm-hmm.
intuition, you know. The way things look, the way things feel, the way things taste. I'm like that with food. I'm like that with wine, you know. And don't get me wrong. I you know, the academic side of it, I didn't go to, you know, I wasn't formally educated. But I like to educate myself.
Mm-hmm.
Best education there is. Yeah, I like all that stuff. But there's the other side of it is that just that feeling, that intuition, that gut, the gut feeling of making wine. I can't explain where it comes from, but it just does. And I think a lot of people that I was around had that same kind of feel, you know, mm-hmm. there's a certain feel to it. When, you know, Larner was one of those sites I went to.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next site after that was Alta Mesa, which I still, make those wines today, which I have one.
Yeah. What else you got? Let's try.
So this is, so after Larner Vineyard,
mm-hmm.
which I made Syrah the first year, then the following year,
that's so.
I mean, got Grenache, but go ahead. No, I know what you're gonna say.
This is crazy. Like it wasn't Larner, but this, like, when you look back, right, and you're thinking about Larner Vineyard now, like, holy shit! Like, I didn't know shit about making wine, and like, I got grapes to make Syrah grapes from Larner to make my first fucking wine.
Well, and this was only their second vintage. The first vintage was so small it didn't go to anybody. I think it actually went to Ganey, and that's where Seth found out about the vineyard, if I remember right. I remember him telling that story,
mm-hmm.
Because he was working there, and it was a really small fermentation, and he was part of that. He got to smell and taste it, and oh shit! So they were looking. Then the next year they had much more fruit to sell. I think it was fourth leaf, I think, if, at that point. It was only one fermenter, but everybody knew it was special, mm-hmm. after the first year. Mm-hmm. Everybody, mm-hmm. Michael Bonacorsi was there. I forget about him. and he was buying fruit as well. Every one of us, Seth, Russell, Michael, myself, everybody knew it was special at that point. And shortly thereafter, it was pretty well known.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, that was a very big moment. I get to make Larner Vineyard Syrah, for my first wine. You know, it was pretty cool. So this is Altas Vinas.
Yep.
And this is from Alta Mesa Vineyard out in the Santa Barbara Highlands.
Okay, yep.
So you know that vineyard out there near mm-hmm. Kuyama?
Yeah,
so
because I used to remember back in the day, who was it? It was Bilo. What was it? Barnwood?
Yeah. This is the old Barnwood now turned into Santa Barbara Highlands.
Yes, yes.
Because Barnwood was a horrible name, remember?
Yeah, it was, yes. It was
like, I don't think you realize that's not a good name for a wine.
Yeah.
They're like, I think it's called Barnyard.
Yeah.
You know, but so I've been making this wine since 2005. I've been making a wine from out there since 2003.
And I saw this is a Moved.
Yeah, this is so based. we have about an acre and a half of Moved and an acre and a half of Grenache out there.
Okay.
And this is from that site. At least the Moved and Grenache component. So it's not a single vineyard, but it's about that site.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I love this story. Yeah, so
3,200 feet elevation. It was being at that time. It was being leased and farmed by Dave Corey from Core Wines, and he was making wine in there. And I met him in 2002, and I said, you know, I really am looking for some Grenache and Moved. And he said, well, there's not going to be any Moved this year in 2003, but I'll have some Grenache. And so I made a Grenache from that year. It was a little bit of Grenache from there. Mostly Grenache from there, and I got a little tiny bit of Grenache from Larner Vineyard
mm-hmm.
that was coming online as well, which is crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty sick.
That smells great.
It does smell great. I mean, it's got dark elements.
So the way we do the Moved and the Grenache from there is we bring it in, we foot stomp it, and it goes into 5-ton concrete fermenters, and it's, you know, anywhere from 35 to 45 days on the skins. Killer. 100% old cluster.
Really? This whole cluster?
Yeah, 100% old cluster.
It's pretty polished for a whole cluster. I mean, I feel the structure, but like, it's not stemmy.
Good stems.
Yeah.
Good stems.
Well,
and also the time on the skins.
Yeah.
You know, and the great thing about concrete is it doesn't get as warm mm-hmm. as, you know, an open top plastic fermenter, you know, a little, or anything stainless, of course. So you don't extract as much from the stems either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a great way to do whole cluster. You get a lot of the aromatics, you get some textural things, you get some structure, but not a lot. But you know, you don't get overwhelmed with that. Some of that can be bitter quality.
Yeah. Well, and you know, again, there's people who like that in their wine. I'm not one who likes that. So I'm always fascinated, and I'm like, wow, this is one of the whole cluster. Yeah, you know, it's means you. Well, it said, you know, I just said your meticulous attention to detail, and you know, my mind always goes to when I hear whole cluster, I think of some natty carbonic, dirty matter.
I don't want to get too much into that. Yeah. But yes, but sometimes those wines, you know, they're not caring for the wine.
That's what
they're letting the wine do what it wants
right,
to
like
do.
That's, and, that, and you're that's like, not that, like, yeah, I mean, yeah. I think most winemakers I talk to are about being a still. It's about, they believe it's the vineyard. They want that to speak.
Of course.
But you have to steward it and guide it. You know, you just want to get out of the way. But like, yeah, there's a laziness sometimes. And some people make, because there's people who make natural wines, they don't label their wines as natural. Because they're not part of a movement. It's a stylistic thing.
It's a stylistic thing.
That they believe will give them the best expression of wine they want to make. Sure. So they're not running around saying, well, this is natural and da-da-da. You know what I mean?
And I think that there's something you brought up that to me is really crucial, right? So it's like people want to make sure that, you know, the site speaks. But the easiest way to ruin a site where it doesn't speak is do something that fucks with the wine.
Right.
Being Brett or VA or it's not topped enough, it's aldehydic. I mean, those are all things that, as you know, I take a lot of pride in this craft that we do.
Yeah.
Making wine is very difficult. Mm-hmm. And to make wine that is sound and is pristine and has purity and shows that sense of place, it's difficult. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult thing. You got to always be on top of your stuff. You always got to be thinking about the wines, what could go wrong, and avoiding what those things, you know. But there is a point where you don't want to over manipulate the wine either.
Of course.
On the other side, which there, right. that is additives and adjuncts and all of the things that cover up the site as well. So there's two things that we're talking about. I like to play right down the middle.
And I think that's, I was talking to Justin about polarization. Like, the, you know, the, there is a thing that comes with polarization. And when I hear people talk about this debate, like natural, and they're talking about, you know, there's people who are just zealots. And they're saying, they lump your wines here in the middle with the mass market shit that has the mega purple. And that's what I think really, really irks me is, I'm like, no. Nobody, you know, when you say, nobody's, when I'm talking about, like you said, I'm talking about people who care about the wine and craft it and really want a sense of place. If you pick too early, if it's dirty in there, if you have Brett, like, so you have Brett, you have VA, the place is not going to show through.
No.
So that, how can you, like,
completely
can,
covering up
you're
the site.
Right.
You're completely covering up the wine. Right.
And you're
and doing, its sense of place and the variety and whether it's the variety of the block or how you made it or whatever it is, it does. But if you're looking to showcase something like that, and you let the wine, you let spoilage organisms get to the wine and change the smell and the taste and the feel.
Yeah.
And then what, you're doing the same thing that...
Well, you're doing the same thing by adding mega purple.
Yeah, exactly. You got this over here and this over here. And I think that it as someone that takes a lot of pride in what we do, me and my team and everybody that's part of this, it's like... We lose sleep over this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So by just letting things go, just going, eh, or the other side of it is, I'll just fix that later.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
And I have said this many times, like what we do in the vineyard to get good grapes is because I don't want to be a wine fixer. Mm-hmm. I want to be a winemaker or a wine grower, as they would say.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get good grapes and just treat them really well all the way to the finish line.
Yeah.
You know, and get them in the bottle soundly. And then that way that wine is going to be good for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Whoever knows, right? But it's like a ticking time bomb in the bottle is not my idea of, doing a job as a winemaker and what's good for me and my customers and the people that enjoy the wines. You know, I want to make sure that if they have it 5 years from now that, you know, the wines are sound and they still show a sense of place. And then you could debate within this middle section,
sure.
You know, a little on the riper side, or a little on the leaner side, a little more of this, a little more of that. But that's all fine,
right?
And those are great discussions.
Right.
And I like all the wines and everything. I like all those styles.
Yep.
And some people could do this leaner style really well.
I'm always blown away when something like I'm like Tegan makes a Senso out of Lodi, out of Betchold.
Yeah, exactly.
12% alcohol. Fuck, it's so... It's the fruit... Everything's there.
Delicious.
Drinkable.
It has complexity.
Yep, yep.
It has texture.
Right.
It has all the check marks.
Right,
you go,
right.
Okay, check.
Right.
That's great.
Right.
And that's a wine that's well made. That's
right.
Taken...
But exactly.
He takes it from the beginning to the end. And I don't know what he does, but I'm assuming, tasting the wine, it's a very, very well made wine.
Very well made.
At 12%, who knows? That could be really beautifully ripe flavors at 12%.
Exactly.
And at 13%, it could have been overripe.
Right.
I don't know. Right. I don't know that vineyard, but you know, the bottom line is, he made a wine that shows a sense of place.
Exactly. It was all about that place. Yeah.
And his style.
Yep.
And his craft. And I dig that. That's awesome. And like I said, those debates in between these two things, you know, it's always going to be that.
Well, though, that's like where I live, right, in this thing. You know what? It's probably not a bad time to take a quick break. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of McPrice Myers. So we'll be right back.
Yeah. Cheers.
Hey, I don't know if I told you guys this earlier, but last year, Grenache Fest sold out within 72 hours. So if you want to be there on November 8th, 2024, make sure that you go over to GrenacheFest.com and sign up for the email list so you will be the first to know when tickets go on sale. I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. This was a one-of-a-kind wine and music festival like no other I've ever seen before. Don't miss out. Go to GrenacheFest.com for more information.
Okay, we're back. I wanted to go back to something you said that I thought was really cool. I want to be a winemaker or a wine grower, not a wine fixer, because, which I totally dig. Goddamn, the blue and black fruit on this is beautiful, my man. And by the way, that's Paco and Ernesto. They're just chiming in because the mailman's here. But you did say, you said the wine fixer. And so, yes, like, for people, you need to understand what Mac's talking about. There literally are companies that fix your wine. There literally are companies that will come, bring a truck, and put a chemical into your wine and fix your wine. And that's like, and that's their whole business.
Or wineries that they have it in internally.
Or internally, yeah.
Yeah, they make a lot of wine, so it's just math, right? You make so much wine, you're going to have, you know, 40% of your lots or 30% or 20%, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You're going to have to do something to correct them in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal is that we don't ever have to do that. Right. But obviously, there's always going to be something here and there. Nothing's going to be perfect, but I don't like to be that. I don't like to have to spend extra money to fix anything.
Right.
I want good fruit, farm honestly, you know, clean, and we're able to, you know, make a good product, an honest product.
Yeah.
That reflects us, reflects the grower, reflects the site, you know, mm-hmm. And it's 100% Grenache now.
Cool. Let's talk about Russell, because you guys, was it a Barrel 27?
Barrel 27.
Barrel 27.
We were both 27 years old.
Yeah.
we were just really creative cats, weren't we? We called it, yeah. Well, we were both into, at that time, we were both really into, and he actually went to Australia and made wine there, but we were both into that whole, the Australian
thing. Well, that was a Grateful Palate. It was big. They were out of Oxnard. Yeah. They were bringing in huge. All those bangers.
And Australian wines back then were massive, right? They were all the rage. And but remember, they used to have like the bin this,
yep,
bin that. So yep. We were like, let's do it, a little twist on it. Let's do Barrel, and we're like Barrel 20, and we're both 27 years old, and so we Barrel 27. And it was great because it started out as I had a couple barrels, he had some stuff, and we put it together. We sold it for a great value, and people loved it. It started to get a little bit of a, especially in the LA area, like Wine House and down at High Time Cellars and Wine Exchange, and those, it got a little bit of a following because it was great value. So anytime Russell and I we hit our number as far as our case production, mm-hmm. we had a bunch of barrels left over and we put those together, and that's kind of how it started. And then we started actually buying fruit for it because it became pretty popular.
What were you producing? You said it was great value. What were you?
Mostly Syrah at the time. Okay. So it was Syrah up until 2005.
Okay.
It was only Syrah. It was just a Central Coast Syrah, with stuff from Paso and from Santa Barbara County. Mostly Santa Barbara County, but stuff from Paso as well. We were buying stuff from French Camp Vineyard out in... which is a great, incredible vineyard, especially for anything value. And back then it was Hank Ashby farming it.
LeGren. They have LeGren out there.
Exactly.
I had Whitcraft LeGren.
And they have Valdigui.
Yeah.
And so that was owned by the Miller family, who owned Central Coast Wine Services.
Got it.
So there was that connection. So we made Syrah up until just Syrah. We just bought Syrah up until 2005. And we started, you know, getting a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of... Tempranillo, a little bit of Petit Verdot, just trying some stuff out. But mostly Syrah. Our main production was two Syrahs. We had the Right Hand Man, which got that name because we created in 2005, we created a wine called Head Honcho. And so you got to have the right hand man if you have the head honcho. Yeah. So the head honcho was like the reserve, and then right hand man was the least expensive, more value, more entry level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was cool.
Tell me about your Grenache, man.
This is 100% Grenache. This is partially from Paper Street Vineyard, which we'll talk about that. I got a bottle of that. We'll try.
Mm-hmm.
That's a vineyard in Willow Creek District.
Mm-hmm.
It's owned by the Ducey family.
Okay.
Incredible site, and they're just, you know, great family, great growers. Lucky enough, I was able to pick out about 52 acres up there, and we have 9 red varieties and 2 white varieties. But Grenache, this is from there and from our estate vineyard.
Okay.
And we have about 10 acres of Grenache up there on all these different exposures and different soils. Not crazy different soils, but, you know, different enough. At least different topsoil, you know. Some, mm-hmm. some are a little more shallow, some are a little deeper. It's great. It's great, great. And so I fell in love with all those 100% Grenaches from the south of France.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. all those like specialty cuvées. So I always wanted to pick out a few barrels mm-hmm. and make that really, you know, those really floral, high tone, kind of cool, like, you know, just showcase the sexy prettiness of Grenache.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, and it's not like you just taught yourself. Obviously, you sought help. But, like, I really think about, like, blown away, like, that you taught yourself this, man.
Yeah, but there was a lot of great people that were around me that I was able to feed off of and learn from.
Yeah.
And frankly, Russell was one of them. I mean, right. Russell was great. I mean, and we both were young guys. We had a lot, tons of passion. We'd like to have fun. Russell's, you know, as you know,
he's a madman.
He's a madman. But, you know, and even back then he wasn't as he is now. I mean, he was, you know, he worked in the cellar there. He was a little more straight laced, but still he was still wild.
Well, Valia, she described, she's like, I saw his hair. It's all crazy.
Oh yeah.
And she's like, I thought he was a freaking Neanderthal.
Oh yeah. he's wild, man. Yeah. I mean, we used to go on the road together and sell wine. It's wild, man. You know? and I already experienced all that. Like I kind of was a wild man before him.
Right.
I did that in my teens and my
early. Like we go 20s. Back to you said like no.
Oh yeah, dude, I was
finding trouble.
Got in trouble all the time. All the time. I was, you know, always getting in trouble and so when I had an opportunity to make wine. And get into this. I treated it a little different than him, even though we were both young guys, and I had a tremendous respect for Russell's, you know, passion and his love for it. And but we were different. I didn't ever want to lose this opportunity. Mm-hmm. I was like, I got an opportunity here. I can't lose it. And he was he for him it was just like, I got this great opportunity to have fun. Really, just let's do this. And I was like, all right, that's cool. But you know, I think we had a little bit different philosophies there. But when it came to winemaking, pretty similar.
Yeah.
You know, he has a tremendous respect for the craft as well. We have different styles, but that's okay. That's good. I think having different styles is great. I think we fed off each other that way. It was. It was really a really good time in that whole that beginning of my career. I really being having all those people doing it yourself is great. I did teach myself, but you have to have things to learn from.
Yeah.
So I learned from all these great people, and being at Central Coast Wine Services was amazing. Oh. You're around people that have been doing it for a long time. They could tell you stories about in the, you know, late 70s and early 80s, and I was fascinated by that. And,
you gotta love, if you want to be, well, for me, that's what I love about wine is the stories.
Yeah.
You know, so, and to get to be around people like, man, I've been making wine at Santa Barbara since 75, you know, whatever. Like,
totally.
I was going to say.
Adam Tolmac.
Hey, Bob. Bob Lindquist.
Yeah.
Who was, God, I'm trying to think. I'm so old. Not that I'm old, but I'm trying to remember as another small producer. But the how long did you guys do Level 20?
Barrel 27. Yeah. We did it for about 10 years.
And what'd you grow the case production to?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably about 15,000 cases.
That's legit.
It, you know what really I would say that eventually kind of hurt us was we were all in on Syrah. We were both,
yes,
you know, Syrah. We're Syrah junkies. Yep. And when Sideways hit, Syrah kind of I know Merlot got the
But generally what happened was, what had happened, because I was in Santa Barbara, was that like, and I love Santa Barbara Pinot Noir, Benicio Pinot, we know Santa Rita Hills. Totally. It's beautiful, delicious stuff. But what was coming on, what's very interesting, what was coming on was, it was the Rhones, like I said, because John Alban had set up shop in the Valley. It was the Rhones that was coming on. And then movie comes out. And
it was like overnight.
Because it didn't hurt. Fuck it. There's Bordeaux stuff in Santa Barbara, and it's gotten way better. But like, it hurt Syrah, like you said, because the red wine that was became known for was Pinot Noir.
Yeah, because on the Central Coast, there was not many people were making Merlot.
Right.
You know, Merlot, exactly. Merlot got hit by the whole thing. Merlot, that was more of a national thing, and the big brands. But for us, Syrah was the other variety that got hit.
Yeah.
And I love that. We were all in on Syrah. Right. And I remember that was, it came out in, that was after the 05 vintage, and we made quite a bit of wine based on, you know, what we felt our demand was. And it was tough. It was tough. It was tough to weather that storm.
Yeah.
Because if you remember, I'm sure you did it. You said Syrah was mm-hmm. the next variety.
Yep, yep.
It was talked about as the next variety, and we were all in. And that, you know, Coupe was making what 25,000, 30,000 cases of their Central Coast Syrah. Mm-hmm. It was really the next thing. I mean, I don't know if it would have ended up being, but it was going that direction, and Sideways kind of derailed that a little bit. And still, I have not made a single Syrah, varietal Syrah, of the production that Russell and I did in 05.
Wow.
I still haven't got back to that point.
Wow.
That's how wow. much it affected. And then, you know, it sometimes could take a decade to change people's mind. Now, when they taste the wine, when I get it in their glass, right. when I'm on the road, oh, it's always God. Their favorite wine.
Right.
But they'll tell you sometimes, I can't sell it.
Yeah.
And it's like, what? Yeah. That's delicious. Yeah. How can you not
sell it? Sell this red wine. Tell people you want a delicious red wine. You know, like that's when you can get generic about it. Hey, I know you love red wine. I know you love this. Try this. Don't forget what you had. Like that, and that's the thing too. Like some of your wines, like people don't get like, I'm like, that's a hand sell, right? Like it's easy to have a wine that make a lot of wine, millions of cases of wine, and floor stack it, and it's just right there, and you just grab it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, but it can be challenging to make a really good wine and actually sell it.
It is. It is. And if it doesn't say Cabernet,
yeah,
you know, that's the challenge. And we make a lot of Cabernet.
Yeah.
We have the M Cabernet, we have our Bull by the Horns Cabernet, and those are the biggest part of production. Those are great wines, and I make them in my style,
yep.
and all that kind of stuff. But those really help us get in the door.
Yeah.
But it's like it's, you know, but when people taste the lineup, you know, the Syrah is like, you know, it's the most like. It's the most intriguing sometimes to these buyers throughout the country, but then they deep down know they can't sell it. Their customer base won't buy it, which is it's sad. It really, but then, you know, you have people that come to our tasting room and come to Paso. They're all about it.
Yeah,
they're all about it. They're all about the blends. They're all about what we do. They're all about, you know, their own varieties. They're about everything. Actually, it could be Zin. It could be Rhone, it could be Bordeaux based, but they're just there. It's a really good audience. They're there. There's really nothing, and typically nothing there. They're just there for good wine, like you said, good red wine made well. has a story behind it, has a personality behind it, has a style behind it. It's great.
Yeah. Speaking of stories, I just popped in. Okay, so you were at the Central Coast Wine Warehouse. Did you ever cross paths with a guy named Christian Garvin?
Christian Garvin? No.
So Christian worked with Andy Kahn. They had a label called Kahn. And Christian did a bunch of... He did a bunch of bulk private label stuff for Trader Joe's. As soon as I tell you the rest of the story, I'm like, I know you came across Christian Garvin because he had to be making wine at Central Coast Wine Warehouse. He's the guy who went to jail for defrauding his partners, for embezzling money.
I know the name.
Yeah, I know you. If you were in Santa Barbara in that time period, Garvin was all up in the piece. So it's just funny. I wonder if you'd crossed paths with him.
No, I didn't. Yeah.
That's so wild. I can't wait to ask someone who did, because I remember Garvin. He was a New York dude, had moved out here, Santa Barbara.
Gosh, Garvin.
Drove a black Lincoln Continental, tried to be it like mysterious. Anyway.
The East Coast baller.
Yeah.
Black SUV. Yeah. Like secret.
Secret Service. Slick, you know, I mean, like, dudes out here wear Dickies, you know, khakis, Chucks, you know, you totally. Go to a wedding. I remember the first time I went to a wedding for someone out here, dudes had on their Hawaiian shirts. I wore a suit, and everybody had their Hawaiian shirt, yeah. And they pressed their khakis.
Oh, yeah, you know? You press them.
Yeah. Anyway, but he always, like, was a little bit slicker, you know. Anyway, I digress. So you and Mac, 15, that's a decent amount of cases, 15,000 cases. That project kind of ended, winded down, ran its course?
Yeah.
Okay.
It did. I mean, we were both really invested in our own brands with his Herman Story and McPrice Myers for me.
When did you, so there you go, that's what I was going to say. When did you start McPrice Myers?
2002.
Okay, so out of the gate, you always had McPrice.
Yeah, and he had Herman Story.
Got it.
And then Barrel 27 was the collaborative brand. Right. And but because of the popularity of Syrah and, you know, the wines were getting popular, we decided to grow that and actually buy fruit for it.
Got it.
As opposed to just being, you know, stuff that we declassified from our own lots. Yeah. And then we moved up. So then we were there to 2008. And when Russell and I were making wine down there, we bought our own equipment and created like a custom crush within a custom crush. So we had clients, which I don't think they liked that too much when we did that. But
it was like, it's like subletting your shit when you're renting space.
Exactly, exactly.
But yeah. I like the hustle. You can't knock the hustle.
And we felt like if we can get a few clients that can help us pay for this equipment that we really couldn't afford at the time. And then we had a client list, you know, and these were all just people we knew, friends of ours. So we had Paul Lotto, Gary Burke from Costa de Oro. We had Matthias Pippig for a couple of years from Sanguis. And then who else did we have? Anyways, we had a few clients. When I say clients, friends that wanted to use our equipment. Mm-hmm. And then we picked up some custom crush clients where we make their wine, Russell and I. So we had a little thing going on in there. But that kind of started slowing down a little bit. And we really wanted to have a place to taste. And Russell and I were, big fans of the community up here in Paso.
Okay.
And we were both making quite a bit of wine from Paso at that point too. There was a facility on the east side where Gerritsen. Do you remember Gerritsen Wine Company?
Mm-mm.
He had a warehouse on the east side, right on 46th East.
Okay.
I heard about that becoming available, and so I looked into it, and it was, and we were able to move in there right after harvest in 2008.
Okay.
At that point, it just so happened that Central Coast Wine Services was building a facility up here, or they built it. Mm. Paso Robles Wine Services. So Paso Robles Wine Services, we were able to transfer our square footage up there, and So we had that warehouse plus that plus the warehouse there. We opened the tasting room, which was the Barrel 27 tasting room, which we both poured our wines on the side, you know.
Yeah.
When we had, you know, club pickup parties and all that kind of stuff, we would all pour all the brands, which was great. It was great. It was a fun time. But, you know, I mean, it just, at a certain point, you know, it's hard. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Personalities clash.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophies change. But, you know, it wasn't easy, but, you know, it was one of those things that happens. But I have a tremendous respect and fondness for Russell. And, you know, he always has good thoughts in my head when it comes to Russell, for sure.
Yeah. And so, talk about Venus.
My partner.
Yeah. So, because you said you had it since, I'm like, okay, and you'd put all your money into it.
Yeah.
So
Venus was a club member. And I had a lease option on the property we're at now.
Okay.
And that option was coming up. And a couple years. And Venus heard, she was a club member, as I mentioned, she heard that I was maybe looking for a partner to invest in the property. Beautiful property. And she approached me. I said, sure, you know, one of those things like, yeah, sure, no problem. I think you want to, yeah, you want to invest in the winery. I'll let you know. But then she followed up, and she followed up again. She became a partner, and we bought the property in 17. And Venus is awesome. Absolutely awesome.
I you know, was doing the backstory. So like, what's her, like, Venus is the owner and style guru. Like, what's that about? Like, I love your website.
Well, because look at me. I wear Dickies. You know? Come on. I wear a uniform every day. No, but, you know, she likes the design side of it.
Right.
You know, we're building a new tasting room. She's very much part of that.
Right.
I don't really care much about that. I mean, I have a certain aesthetic I like to look, you know, like to see. And I don't want things to be too fancy. But, no, it was... and she's very successful. I mean, she's, you know, she's... essentially retired now, but she had a lot of success in her own business, which is genetics.
Mm-hmm.
She created the Velocigene, which is this crazy gene that helps you with making these antibody cocktails. So very, very brilliant. But wow. She really wanted to get into the wine business.
Right.
So style guru. That's just because she's
no, all, I, no. But I think
when we designed the house up top and all that kind of stuff, she gets into that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And I just bring it up because I think, like, you know, there's lots of ways you can want to position yourself in the market. Yeah. You know, and then Adrian Perez, who's the social member and brand partner who runs a CrossFit boot camp out of the cellar, enjoys doing pull-ups on the grape hopper.
Yeah. He could be that way, you know, especially when he's doing the whole 30 diet. He gets all into the working out thing. But it's the whole thing is about that. It's making wine's hard work,
yeah.
You know, and I think we joke around about that a lot. But that's, you know, when you get the interns working and that kind of stuff. And he's also a brand partner. He's been 12 years.
Okay.
12 years. Starting as cellar guy, one day a week. Then he went full time. Then he became cellar master. And then he took over as assistant winemaker, now associate winemaker. Promoted him in a couple years back and offered him to be a brand partner as well.
That's so
brought cool. him in. Yeah, no, it's great. Adrian has an incredible palate, he's super passionate. And we have a great team. We built a great team in the cellar, and he's a big part of that.
This is the best.
You gotta have great. As I always tell you, you gotta have great people.
Yeah.
You gotta have incredible people that share your vision.
Yep.
That want to be part of it, and just, you know, you gotta have a great team. Yeah. Have a great team, because this is a lot of work. It's super competitive. It's hard work. It's a challenging business for sure.
I think, and that's why I like to tell the stories, because there's a lot of glitz and gloss around every part's business, even being a sommelier. Like, people are like, do you know how to do a budget? You can't just pick a wine list just on what you want. You have to be able to sell wine. There's formulas you have to have. There's managing people. It's not just like, oh, wine is this beautiful. And wine is this beautiful, amazing beverage. That's why I do it. But, like, you know, you have to have a team, right? And then you have to have a team that if you, well, depending on what you want to do, like, I asked, what profession would you like to do? I was like, well, I get to do what I want to do. And is that great? And you also get to do it with people you want to work with. What else we got here, my man?
Yeah. No, I mean, look, there's a lot of things that people talk about when they talk about being a winemaker. Mm-hmm. But being a winemaker and owner, mm-hmm, and kind of a head of an organization, I learned a lot working at Trader Joe's because I was a manager. So being a supervisor, mm-hmm, managing people, mm-hmm, is crucial. But building a culture,
yeah,
that is very, very difficult, and that's a hard thing to establish. Because this business is hard enough, and if you don't have great people and you don't have a culture built around what you do and that shared vision and people that are passionate and like their job. That's the number one thing I always ask Liz, who's the director of operations. Do they like working here? First question, because it's like that starts it off. If they don't, why do we need to fight this?
Yeah.
But building a culture is tough. And on the winemaking side, there's all this other stuff that's not glamorous. Logistics,
exactly,
and timing, and penciling stuff in, and we got to play Tank Tetris and all that other, that's another thing. But just having a business and running a business and having the front of the house and the back of the house, and then your vineyard team and all the different things. But if you have a good culture and people enjoy where they work, mm-hmm, I think it's a lot easier to accomplish those things.
100%. Okay, the color is amazing.
This is Paper Street Cuvée.
Okay, yeah, talk about Paper Street. Yes.
Yeah. So Paper Street Vineyard is a vineyard up on Kyler Canyon in Willow Creek District of Paso. This was this is owned by the Ducey family.
Okay.
They bought the property in, I think, 2012. Mm-hmm. They had it cleared and allowed me to go up there and talk to them and great opportunity to get on the ground floor of this great vineyard. I'm super lucky. So we have 9 red varieties and 2 white. And one of the white varieties I had to kind of... not beg, but try to convince them was Claret Blanche. We planted up there.
Nice.
And Claret Blanche does really well up there.
Okay.
But we have Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre with this, which this is.
Okay.
The blend changes every year.
Yep.
This is a single vineyard wine from that site, and mm-hmm, we have no rules when we make it.
Okay.
It's the best wine from this site,
mm-hmm,
that we could possibly make. In this vintage, it's just 3 varieties, which we've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
But we have Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèdre. We have Petit Verdot, Cabernet Sauvignon. We have Zin. We have Graciano. And we have Cunoise and Sanso.
Ah,
and
so
on the white side, we have Grenache Blanc and Claret Blanche, which we blend together to make our beautiful earth white. It's usually around 50-50, about that every year from that site. And it's great.
I'm digging everything you said about that vineyard, man. From the Zinfandel to the Cunoise to the Cinso. I love me some Cinso. You don't find a lot of it on its own. But South Africa, you'll find some.
Yeah.
Down in the Rhone.
Basadi family.
Isabel Ferrando. She makes one. She's one of the few people who makes 100 Cinso, but it's like $650 bucks a bottle.
Yeah, exactly.
Not a shout enough.
Cunoise. She's a great winemaker.
She's an incredible winemaker.
No more Sans Préfère, though.
Yeah.
It's all Isabel.
It's all Domaine Ferrando.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. She changed the names.
Yeah.
And the Cinso and Cunoise do incredible on this site.
Yeah.
The Cunoise, the grafts, right, not all the grafts took, but the Cinso is, from this last, especially this last year, was amazing. And 22, but... It does well. Loves heat. It doesn't dent it. It's like this site is really, really. It's high elevation, rocky, and the Cinso just breezes right through it. So this is 58 Syrah, 28 Grenache and 14 Mourvèdre.
Yeah.
And the blend changes every year. Some years, I mean, it's been as much as 7 varieties.
Mm-hmm.
So I think like we're working on the 2022, and currently it's like Syrah, then Zin, then Grenache, and then finish with Cinsault.
That's fun.
Yeah,
yeah, like you said, there's no rules.
No rules, man. We're not dogmatic that way.
Just, incredible color, beautiful nose, savory. You know, you're getting that bacon fat, but then just all types of blue and black fruit, and then on the mid palate, you're getting some red fruit. I mean, this is hits all notes. There's a little orange peel, orange rind in there.
Yeah, you get that blood orange rind.
Yep.
There's always this especially for all the Rhone stuff. There's this almost like a passion fruit kind of almost like it's been co-fermented kind of edge to the wines when you have them by themselves. So that's great. You picked up that orange rind,
yeah,
like cranberry orange.
Yeah, relish. Yeah, exactly. That's yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That would say the red fruit is like a cranberry, like literally, yeah, Ocean Spray cranberry orange fucking relish for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
grab it. Yeah, that, and you get into that blood orange, and you get into the spice, and then you know, with this site being so chalky and rocky, you get all that like chalky, like almost like I always say, like a chewable vitamin thing.
Yeah,
not that like that's a, but you know,
no, but
like after you have that's it, that the chalky. Thing.
That's the thing that helps people understand. I think people who are just going to want to understand wines, like if you've had a children's vitamin. Like it's minerally, but it's that chalk, or it's that dust on.
Yeah, it's not the flavor of it when you eat it. Right. It's the leftover residual, right, right, that like chalky.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, when you're a kid, you get the initial flavor of like a Flintstones, right, vitamin. Right. But then when you're walking to the bus stop, you're like that chalky.
Yeah,
yeah, or like Pixie Stick or something like that. You know?
Oh my God, Pixies. Yeah. Sweet tarts were the same way.
Yeah, yeah, but it's not the flavor.
It's not the flavor.
It's the residual chalky. It's the texture of it. Yeah.
Chalking. And all those. Remember chalky fucking candies?
Yeah.
Pisky sick, like, die on that.
Exactly.
Just pouring sand down your throat.
Oh, it's just like, pure sugar. Sugar, the stick with sugar. Just, it is in chalk form. It was like chalkboard chalk with just sugar and sweetness. It was horrible. But it's just, it's not like really a flavor thing. It's just a texture and you can feel it. But it's definitely, I from the minute I had Rhone wines from Paso, that flavor was instantly something I picked up. It was that a cool, like aromatic, you know, you get that, those really bright aromatics with limestone.
Yep.
Really just that floral, and you almost like, you can almost smell the chalk. I fell in love with that flavor profile. And this vineyard excels with that. You know, it has that really, really cool chalky and that floral and almost like tropical. There's like almost like a tropical edge to the wines that I don't know. It's just something that,
yeah,
it's very, very, it's very intriguing to me. It's like this, you know, and then, you know, with Paso wines, things that a lot of people don't talk about. They talk about the power. They talk about, you know, the opulence and all these buzzwords, but, you know, not enough people talk about the freshness and vibrancy.
The acid.
You know, there's so much vibrancy in these wines.
Yep.
I mean, this wine is probably, not that numbers matter, but it's probably 3.3, 3.4 pH, 6.5 grams of acidity. So that's where the magic lies.
Right, because some people that's are like, oh my God, people go, it's 15.6 alcohol, and it's going to be just blah.
Yeah.
No, there's no cloying. It's super fresh.
Vibrant.
Like,
yeah.
To the point of like, and it's a baby. So this is a wine that can last for 20 years easy.
Yeah, it's got all the check marks, right?
Yeah.
It's got the nice tannins. It's got the beautiful acidity. But that's the one thing that was another thing that, you know, I try my best to teach people is that, you know, there's stylistic wines that people make. We talked about it earlier, where they try to fit them into this mass produced,
mm-hmm,
you know, very accepted style.
Right.
That's okay. I'm not begrudging that.
Right.
For us, I want to show what the site does, and what you know, what we like as winemakers and our team, and I love the freshness, you know, and that's the magic that Paso has, right? You get we have plenty of sunshine.
Yeah.
But that balancing out the acid that keeps it fresh and vibrant and lifted, that's where I think
I love that term, lifted. Yeah, because I love that. Got a couple more.
Yeah. All right. So this is our estate.
Oh shit. Right.
Yeah.
I love estate. That. And I just, it's like you, bro. It's like your shirt. Like it's just black. Totally. It's clean.
Totally. Yeah. We keep it simple, yeah, man. You know, I'm a uniform guy.
Exactly.
I found out really early on, like, if I don't have to think about my clothes, it makes my day a lot easier.
It's so true, right? Look at the game. Talking about freaking color, bro.
Yeah. So a similar blend. This is 60 Syrah. 20 Grenache, 20 Mourvèdre.
Okay.
This is all from our estate vineyard, which farmed by Aaron Navarez, who farmed all the Denner properties for 20 years.
Got it.
He's now full-time with us, and he's head of viticulture for us. He's great. He's great. And he's been working with me since we moved to the property.
Okay.
So we moved on the property in 14, and... One of the things I before I signed the lease with the option to buy, I said, I want to have the tasting room so we can really kind of gauge the foot traffic and that road. I wanted to be able to lease the vineyard from so we can kind of, because the vineyard was a bit neglected and I really didn't want to waste any time getting it back. And Aaron actually came to me and said, if you're thinking about anybody to help you with the vineyard, I would love to do this because I like this site and I want to bring it back because it's too good of a site.
That's
and
great.
So he's been working with me since 17 and then full time this last year. So this is our estate. Yeah, this is
just like you're the best of your best.
Yeah, like the best barrels. It's not really the best barrels. It's never that simple.
No,
but the idea is, yeah,
the notion is
it's the best barrels that come together to make this wine.
60-20-20.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a serious one.
That is a serious one. That's a serious one. I mean, they're all, but like, you could, like, that's one, like, again, you're like, I was with Justin, he had a 2005. Like, people are, so I was like, it's a 19-year-old Saxon, right? That wine. And it was beautiful. This wine in 20 years will still have beautiful fruit.
Yeah.
Beautiful structure.
Mm-hmm. That's the idea.
Yeah. You can tell.
Yeah. There's when I pour them in this because this is mostly all Rhone stuff that we're drinking.
Yep.
We'll finish with a Cabernet because I want you to try our inaugural release of Cabernet from the Beautiful Earth. But this we finished this one because there's just a density.
Oh yeah.
To it. Yeah. There's just like this, you know, like, you know that it has more to, a lot more to give over time, and
black licorice in there. Way on the back, and also, but also, it does have that beautiful, like you said, tropical citrus tropical. Like, I think passion fruit. When I think of an exotic fruit that's kind of tropical, but it leans towards citrus, it is passion fruit. Like, yeah. I said, it's definitely.
It's like you could like you it's like that. You kind of smell all those, like the blood orange to the cranberry to the passion fruit. You kind of all hit that whole. But then that, you know, that structure, but polish. But to me, it's the density with this wine.
Oh, good Lord. That's so good.
There's a core to it, right?
Yep.
A little more bone, you know, along with the flesh. But that there's a core to the wine. And that's just, you know, it's very low yielding. We're bringing this vineyard back. I mean, it's doing much better now. You know, especially this last year was an incredible year, but it takes time to bring the vineyard back.
All right.
And if you're doing it, yeah, you do it the right way. And Aaron's, you know, doing a great job, and he kicks butt, and I'm lucky to have him. But we're very proud of what we got on the estate property for sure. All these wines,
they're sick, man. Mm. Now I knew we have another Beautiful Earth, but while we're just sipping on this, talk about hardworking wine.
Hardworking wine. So I have a huge fondness for and love for value wine. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter where it's from, but when I started getting into wine,
Like you said Marquis de Riscal. It's probably like $7.
That was like, back then. Yeah, it was probably $7.99. That was one. But I used to go to wine shops all over, mm-hmm. and great value wine. There's something special about it.
I wholly agree with you.
I think that there's not enough people.
A good
$15
bottle of wine is. I live for that. Live for that, dude.
And when you get it, it's amazing. So I used to go to all kinds of wine shops, and I would say, I didn't make a lot of money, but I wanted to taste a lot of different wines. So I would always go into some place and go, okay, I'm going to try Chianti Classicos. And I want to get a case of wine. I can't spend that much money. And, you know, one here, one there, they're okay. Right. And then every once in a while you hit one, you're like, damn. And then you read up on that producer, and you're like, okay, these people are doing things right. I always had a thing for that. And the Barrel 27 Days were fit into that as well.
Yeah.
You know, but that idea of, you know, making great value, and it's really hard. I don't think people realize how hard it is to make great value wine.
It's a lot easier to make a shitty wine and sell it for $40 than it is to make a good
value. Absolutely.
A lot easier to do that.
And so the hardworking wines, they're all about, you know, me and my team, we're mm-hmm. all hardworking. We mm-hmm. all get out there. We're all, it's a very, very hardworking bunch. But it's also about the wines themselves, right? They deliver. And I think that everybody deserves to have a good bottle of wine, no matter how much mm-hmm. money you make. Mm-hmm. And I take a lot of pride in these wines because they're the wines that get out to the most people. Mm-hmm. And the most people get to consume the wine that's made by me and my team. And it's great. And so those wines are, that's kind of that ode to how I got into the wine world with that value, working on the retail side and really appreciating when you can stumble onto a great wine for a great price. There's something special about that. It's almost like more exciting sometimes to stumble onto that
than
it is when you try a unicorn wine for $800 a bottle.
No,
it's supposed to be good.
Exactly. No, I wholly agree with you on that. I mean, like, when I find like a freaking like $8 Garnacha from Spain,
yeah,
I'm like, fuck,
it's killer.
I'll take two cases of that.
Yeah, it's killer.
That's a new house wine. Or $15 Monastrell Umiel. Umiel is a region that all I feel over delivers what they do with, you know,
absolutely.
Monastrell. It's like it's like freaking insane.
Absolutely.
And
Bierzo with Mencia.
Oh my God!
Go down the list. There's all these you know, and a lot of, you know, there's some cool like Italian regions that are starting to come online, yeah. making great stuff. I mean, Italy's just having a full rebirth right now, right. in my opinion,
yeah,
for like wine quality. But you know, but this value, like. Getting, it doesn't, to me, it doesn't matter what price the wine is, but if you go, holy shit, that's a great wine
right.
for this price.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter how much it is.
Right.
If it's $10, if it's $100.
I would tell people, like, I'm like, yeah, okay, see this like, fucking Clio from Spain.
Yeah, Clio.
Juan Gil.
Yeah, that's all made
bucks.
By Chris Ringland.
Yeah. But still, like if that was from Napa, it would cost $150.
Oh, yeah. The Clio and the El Nido.
El Nido.
Yeah, which is the Cab Morven.
Right.
70-30,
yeah.
And yeah, it's but look, when you try those wines, the first thing you think about when you try them is you put your note, it's these people cared about what they
exactly.
did from start
yep.
to finish,
yep.
how they grew the fruit,
yep.
when they picked, how they picked, how they fermented it, how they stored it, you know, how they took care of it. There's a pride there in what they do, because we've how many bottles, you know, you can sit there and pop 15, 20 bottles or go to a tasting
yep.
and you don't taste that with everything at that price.
No.
You know, they just threw it together.
Right.
And shoved it into a bottle and you're like,
I know what you did there.
I know what you did.
That's what I said. Like,
yeah.
A dangerous zone in particularly American wine is like that 30 to 50 range, because some people just like.
Exactly.
That's a dangerous zone, because it's a Napa Valley, and it will be from Napa Valley, but it's like. Third discarded declassified fruit, you know what I mean?
That's been fixed.
Exactly.
That's been fixed. It's ran through some machine.
Yeah.
You know, to be fixed, you know. And I think absolutely. That's actually, it's a good point. I didn't think about that. That 30 to 50 is the most like risk taking.
Yeah.
Because it could be really inexpensive for one region.
Right.
Or like really, you know, or high end somewhere else. So you kind of don't know where you're going to fit in there. It could be like really, yeah, okay, that's interesting.
As a guy who loves retail, just for, I like to help people and come back, oh my God, that wine, like, I'm like, trust me, put that. And like, if you're gonna spend $15 or $20, trust me, just try this. And they come back, oh my god, that's a lot. So I've observed that, and yeah, it's a funny spot. We got one more. We got Unamas.
Unamas.
I don't even want to pour this out, man, but it's so freaking good. They're all delicious.
So then we
and this just got some decent scores from like the Advocate, or was it Lisa?
I think it was.
You got some good acclaim.
This is our Butifourth Cabernet. This is our first vintage, and it took me, you know, 3 or 4 years to kind of get to the point where we can make this.
Okay.
We do Butifourth wine, the red wine, which is very popular for us.
Yep.
Which is more of a Rhone influence blend. But we have some incredible sites, being Paper Street, our estate, and one out by Tobias Creek called Armory, which is a dry farmed Cabernet vineyard farmed by Will John, who's a great farmer in his own respect. We do a lot of business with him. And so this is, yeah. So I thought it'd be fun just to kind of finish with a little Cabernet.
I love
it. And so this is my take on Cabernet from Paso.
And while we're doing this, just to complete for me to tie a bow around hardworking wines, High on the Hog, the Zin. Where does that Zin come from? Is that from Paper Street Vineyard, or where are you going to?
The Pound for Pound is
pound
the Zin.
Pound for Pound is
the
Zin. Yeah.
Is the Zin? Now that partially Paper Street.
Okay.
And partially from a vineyard on the east side called J&J.
Okay.
And so we blend those two together.
I love that fucking wine. And also, and then High on the Hog, I love too. Dude, I was like, these
wines.
Like, when you talk about your, I'm like, fuck. Fuck.
That wine's great too. Yeah. But that one is, so we buy some fruit for it.
Yeah.
But that one gets a nice dollop of all of our blue chip stuff.
When we
hit our numbers, it's right. Like,
we got, it's,
I got, you know.
It's like what Morgan does with Shebang, right? So,
exactly.
So Morgan, Twain, Peterson,
same exact.
Like has all these single year wines, and then he has a wine called Shebang, and it's like $15 to $20 where you buy, and it's like all old vine fucking fruit because he made his wine, and it's the whole Shebang, and so that you tell me you get like, well, you know what, we already got the estate, we got this.
It's a little bit of the same.
Top
thing.
It off, yeah.
Yeah, where we have always have a few barrels left over of a bunch of stuff, and. So it gets a smattering of different.
That's so cool.
Some like Paper Street, some of our state vineyards, some of this vineyard, some of that vineyard. So this is Butifourth Cabernet. And of course, I'm a huge Rhone guy. So, but this is 4% Syrah, and then 4% Petit Verdot. Which Petit Verdot comes from Paper Street as well, which is a great site. That always comes off last. It's killer stuff.
But I think Stefan gave people. gave people the permission to like, yo, no, I'm going to blend Cabernet with Syrah because I couldn't do that in Bordeaux, but I could do that shit here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, I think there's a few producers that got into people's heads. He was the first producer from, you know, a guy from France to come over here and do that.
Right.
But like Domaine Trevelon.
Yeah.
You know, and Le Grand Chaper.
Yeah.
Those are all people that were kind of breaking that mold there.
Right.
And then when he came here, but it was more tasting those wines too.
Yeah.
It was like, holy shit, that works.
Right.
And we do a wine in a similar blend to that, which is blend to that is Syrah, Cabernet, and Petit Verdot. Mm-hmm. And those, they work well.
Yeah.
And absolutely. He's a huge influence for that wine, you know, because he makes incredible stuff.
Yeah.
And yes, he did. He did, but I think Paso allows that, which is great.
Goes back to Ed Jensen when he said, Paso's the Wild West. We do what the fuck we want to do here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, I think that he showed people, but he also came to this community because of that. Because
exactly.
it was the perfect fit for him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never talked to him about it, but I you know, from what I've read, and you know, that's why he's here. That's why he's in Paso.
Yeah.
You know, you know, we're still finding ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna, you know, what we're making 100 years from now, who knows?
Yeah.
But we're a young region, I think we're really kind of it, which is great because I think with us being able to experiment with the different things and playing around with different blends and varieties and sites and all the different things that we're doing. You know, we're always pushing that envelope. You know, we don't have to adhere to a set of wines that, you know, like frankly, like they do in Napa, where it's You know, you got to make Cabernet, 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 maybe a Merlot, maybe a blend, maybe a Chardonnay, maybe a Sauv Blanc. But what you make is pretty much set.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just because that's what fetches the money.
Right.
But here, you know, I think we don't have any rules. And it is the Wild West. You know, it's Wild West, but it's also, there's a little more order to it, you know?
Yeah.
It's a little more, there's a little more thought put into it. It's cool. It's just, there's a lot more liberties in what we can make and do and how we put our wines together and really putting our own singular, you know, thumbprint on it, which is great. Mm. Yeah.
All right, man, I got a couple more questions. This has been so great. I hate this app. We have a conversation. We have questions. I literally have two questions. this is a game, though. It's called Slap, Lick, Fondle.
Okay.
Let me give you three grape varietals. You have to slap one. You get to slap one. Get to lick one. Get to fondle one.
All right.
All right. So we're going to do... We're going to do it, Mac. I mean, when I did this, the first time I did this, it was under FMK. I did Fuck, Marry, Kill, but I changed it up because someone bit my shit. So I was like, all right.
got it.
Yeah, so... But I did it in hospice, and it was Grenache, Syrah, and Mourvedre, but I'm going to do something different. So we're going to do Zinfandel, Cabernet, and Mourvedre for you. Which one you're slapping, which one you're licking, which one you're going to fondle.
Ooh, that's a good one. So what would you say? Zinfandel, Cabernet...
And Mourvedre.
And Mourvedre.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good one. Oh, that's a good one. All right, I'm gonna say, slap Cabernet.
Okay.
What'd you say?
Lick,
and
fondle are the other two choices you have left now.
Oh, that's a tough one. Those are.
It's supposed to be.
Yeah. I'm going to change it up a little bit. I'm going to slap Mourvedre.
Okay.
I'm going to lick Cabernet, and I'm going to fondle Zinfandel.
Right on.
Yeah, that's my final answer.
Okay. And McPrice Myers, what are you most excited about in the future?
Good question. I think Where the wine industry is going, for sure, I think that experimenting with new varieties, new sites, I think our estate, you know, we're planting more in our estate. I would say the development of our estate.
Very cool. Very cool. And now Dan is early and Ernesto and Paco are back. But you guys know I just have a real podcast that's raw as fuck. So Mac, this is awesome, man.
Cheers.
Love the wines. Thank you so much. Tell people how they can find you and how they can be a part of what you're doing.
Yeah, we're McPriceMyers.com. We're on Adelaide Road. We have a tasting room open 7 days a week. Come out and visit us.
Yeah. And for all your listeners out there, don't forget to check out the show notes for each episode. You'll find I'll list the wines we drank. I'll put links to their website, their social, and that's where all the good stuff is. And until the next time, cheers to the Mavericks. You check that box, philosophers. Check that box, deep thinker. Wine nerds and wine drinkers. It's your boy MJ saying peace.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers, guys.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you learned something. You had some fun while you were here. Please subscribe to the podcast and give us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening to. And if you want to be an insider and get special content, make sure you go over to blackwineguy.com and get on our email list.